And now I'm going to introduce the speaker. And this guy I've known for a long time. I remember when I first met this guy, you know, he was like, I was scared to death. And I remember hearing a little bit of his story each time, you know. And I said, wow, man. I said, I'm grateful I'm not him, man. But, you know, I really did. I said, man, I'm grateful. You know, I said, I prayed hard for this guy, man. I really did, because I said, this guy really needs some prayer, you know. And he was in a world of shit. And I watched this guy come out of this world of shit. It made my life so stronger. It made my weakness so strong that it's unreal, you know. So at this time, I'd like to introduce my buddy, Ron.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ron.
Hey, Ron.
And I'm an alcoholic. And I guess I got to talk about being in a world of shit. Well, I need to have a little humor, you know, when I get up here to speak, because, you know, it was true. My life was definitely self-will run riot, you know, and I had no control, no direction. It was like a ship without a rudder, you know, and I'd bounce around in different places, and every once in a while it'd be good, you know. Some places were good, and then, but a lot of places were bad, and you know, those were consequences of my drinking. But you know, I'm gonna tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it was like now. And I grew up in a little town in South Carolina, and I really thought, you know, my family wasn't too bad starting out. I never quite felt, you know, like everybody else. I was, you know, irritable, restless, and discontent right out of the chute. And I never felt, you know, I always had to be a clown, you know, to feel like I fit in. You know, sarcasm, humor, and really it was just covering up fear that I had. And I know that now, but I didn't know it then. And, you know, that life led on fear really screwed my decision-making process up. And, you know, I saw my father, you know, beat my mom, and he beat me, and, you know, it wasn't, he would be in jail if he would have got caught, you know, these days doing it. And, you know, he would take a lot of stuff out on me. I had two older sisters, and they never had any problems, you know, with him, but for some reason we just didn't get along, and he would take his anger out on me. But you know, his father died when he was really young, so he didn't really know how to handle a young crazy boy. And you know, it was very dysfunctional. My mother was a drunk. All my father's brothers were drunk, and I think he was he would drink on a very rare occasions, but when he did, things happened. And my mom and he and my mom had a house at the beach, and I was like 8 years old, you know. And they came home. I heard my sister's husband's father came and picked me up, and he told me my mom had shot my dad. And you know, I already had a low self-esteem, and I was in a small town, and I already didn't feel like I fit in. But when you have to face people, you know, that ask you what happened, you know, and everything else, you know, it's very humiliating, you know, to, you know that your parents, like, so that set me up for low self-esteem and an isolator, because I didn't, you know, want to be around anybody. And it also instilled a lot of anger in me. So when my father would take out his anger on me, I would take it out on other people. And it, you know, I have I hurt a lot of people, you know, as a kid, you know, growing up, until, you know, I started smoking pot, and then I just kind of mellowed out. But thank God for that, you know. But you know, I can remember my first drink. When I was 7 years old, and my uncle, we'd have family reunions, and my uncle would always walk around with a pint of Seagram 7 in his back pocket. And that it mesmerized me, you know, even then. I'd never tasted alcohol before, but I wanted to try it. And finally I talked him into it, and he let me try some. And it was the horrible, most nasty thing I'd ever put in my mouth. But, you know, it's weird that I remember that, because I eat green beans all the time, and I never remember the first time I ate green beans. And, you know, I remember the alcohol. But I didn't get any feelings from it. You know, I didn't swallow a whole lot of it. And I didn't get that golden moment that Bill Oakley talks about, you know, when I feel that I fit in, the ease and comfort. You know, I could talk to women. I could dance. I could do everything. I'd found my solution in the bottle. And that was when I was 13. And I remember we had hot dogs, and my mom would make this thing with mustard and onions, you know, and she put them on the hot dogs. And it was me and two of my buddies. We'd always go to the beach in South Carolina that was close to our house, where the beach house was. And we had some alcohol. I don't remember where we got it, but we had a little bit of everything. So I blacked out that night. The first time I got drunk was a blackout drunk. And I remember waking up the next morning, and there was stuff on the floor. You know, right at one, there was a big pile on the head of my bed, and there was one right next to my bed, and it looked exactly like that stuff I'd ate the night before. And I'm like, I don't even remember, you know, getting sick or anything, but my mom remembered. And, you know, it was in the middle of July, and it was like 110. And the sand was that deep in our yard, and the grass was about that high, and she had me out there cutting the grass, and I had the worst hangover that I think I've ever had in my life. And I can remember running and jumping in the ocean, and it was nice and cool, and it felt so good to be in that water. And when I was out there, I was thinking about when I was going to get to do it again. You know, that's another strange thing in my life, because one time my mom made some blueberry turnovers, and I had a friend over spending the night, you know, and he didn't like them. So I have a little bit of an obsessive personality, and I ate every damn one of those blueberry turnovers. Well, about midnight I woke up, and I was felt like I was, you know, so sick it was like projectile vomiting all over my room. Blueberries everywhere. And you know, I haven't touched a blueberry since that day. But the alcohol, I like the effect. I like what it made me feel like when I drank it, you know. And I believe that alcohol was to get drunk. I never drank socially. I didn't think about drinking socially. And I didn't even realize that people did that. I just thought when you drank, you got drunk. And I did. And it started out, you know, like on the weekends, you know, and then it progressed till it was during the week, and I was cutting school, and we were drinking and getting in trouble. And, you know, eventually alcohol became my master at a very young age. And I could not imagine doing anything without drinking or going anywhere that didn't have it. You know, it was a part of my life. I was in the bondage of the alcohol, you know. I get that way on cigarettes, any other type of substance that is addictive. I'm like on fire when it comes to that stuff. So I got to be careful of what I do, because I've put myself in bondage several times in sobriety. Not to mention, you know, when I was out there drinking. But, you know, I got married. And it was all party, you know. We'd broken up two or three times, and I remember telling her something about if she ever got pregnant, I would marry her. So I was trying to get my life straightened out a little bit, and I enrolled in college, and I was doing real well, freshman of the year. I was on the dean's list. I had a 4.0 GPR, and she came to visit one weekend. And well, you know, it was a good weekend. And my son was conceived that weekend. So we got married. And man, it was just like one. We were both severe alcoholic addicts. And it wasn't pretty, you know, and we stayed married for 4 years and then we got divorced. But that was one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I have a loving son now, and he's really a big part of my life. But, you know, it was just right before we got divorced, my mother and I was put into a treatment center. My first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was in 1987. And I went to this treatment center, and, you know, they had like, it was unbelievable. You know, they had like 8 different types of eggs for breakfast that you could think of: scrambled, poached, sunny side up, eggs on toast, you know. Then they'd have flounder almondine for lunch. And I was like, damn, this is pretty nice. This is the best vacation I ever had, even up to this day. And, you know, we got to watch football, and they take us out to meetings, you know, and we go drink coffee and everybody. I love it when you see the newcomers coming in here, man, and they all have those energy drinks, and they're like, hey, what you doing? Hey, what's going on? Hey, how you doing? Yeah. And they're all, you know, they want something. They want to feel something. So they get blasted on this caffeine, and you can tell they're all... I did the same thing, but look, we didn't have energy drinks back then. We had coffee. And I just drank a lot of coffee. And, you know, it was... It got me out of the environment, you know, that I was in. And it was a good thing. You know, I'm not saying treatment doesn't work, but I wasn't ready. You know, I didn't... You see these shows like Intervention and stuff like that, and the people are hardly ever ready to accept spiritual help. You know, it says that if you go to a meeting and you hear How It Works read, and it says, if you see you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Well, I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready. I didn't see what you had is what I wanted, because my life hadn't sucked enough yet. But I did manage to stay sober or dry for 5 years. And I remember when I first went to AA, I said, Alcoholics Anonymous, they're going to teach me how to drink without getting in trouble. Yeah. Nobody's going to know. It's anonymous. Then they told me, nope, that isn't how it works. But anyway, you know, I was the boy whistling in the dark for 5 years. And, you know, I was white knuckling. You know, I didn't work a step. I felt so awkward, you know, like I was damaged goods. Because I was, you know, just pretty much at my mother's discretion. I felt like I was crazy. And they had a vocational rehabilitation, placed me in a job. And it was with 4 other guys that got out of treatment at the same time I did. And, you know, everybody would look at you. And, you know, finally I started doing, like, weird quirky stuff, you know, to make them think, you know, like... You can see them watching me, and nobody ever came around you, you know. But I just felt like, you know, I felt like I was the center of attention. Everybody was watching me, and that was just my self-centeredness. But there was a guy there that I kind of palled out with, and his name was Calvin Saxon. And we would go to meetings, you know, all over the place, and he'd already had his bottom half of his leg amputated because he was in a drunk driving accident. And it messed his leg up so bad they had to cut it off. And he would, you know, walk around on a prosthesis. And he got along all right. And I remember one day going to work and Calvin wasn't there. I'm like, what happened to Calvin? He said, well, you didn't hear? And they're like, no. Well, he was on the way home one night and... he got in a head-on collision, drunk. He picked up again, and he killed a whole family. It was like 4 people that he killed, and he lived. And I could see how everybody, you know, looked down on him with disgust and disgrace, and even I did it. I was judging him. You know, look at what this guy's done, man. It's hard to believe. And you know, they say that you don't think things are going to happen to you in AA or in, when you're drinking. You know, that's a disease. You know, oh, that'll never happen to me. You know, that won't happen to me. And you know, I never saw Calvin again. I'm sure he's still in prison for what he did. But you know, that was so horrible and horrific. You know, and it didn't do anything for me. I still, like I said, I eventually moved to Florida, started drinking again slowly. You know, I'd pick up like a beer on the way home from work. Then it turned into two. Then it turned into three. Then it turned into the bar. And you know, I'm a single parent. I have a son at home that's in grammar school. You know, and I go home and I'm too drunk to cook or help him with homework or be a dad or do anything. And that was a nightly occurrence. And 1995, my life started spiraling downward, and I really didn't know. I had a business. I was doing a paper recycling company where we do post-consumer products. It was printing companies and these tall buildings downtown. We started recycling programs with them, and it was new and upcoming, and people were all over it. And everybody was wanting to join in, and the business boomed, you know. And it's a commodity, just like, you know, gold and silver. The prices go up and down with the market. Every month, the price changes. Well, the first month I was in, my buddy had been in it for like 5 or 6 years, and he kept badgering me about going into business, you know, working for him. You want to work for me, you want to work for me. And it never interested me until he said, would you like to go in business with me? I'll give you 10% of the business. So he opened his books and showed me what was going on. I'm like, okay. And it would have been modest, you know, modest living. And the month after I got in, the prices, the government stopped virgin pulp from going into the paper mills, and it was all recyclable product, and it went up. All prices went up 400% in 1 month. So we were banking. You know, it was me and him, and one other lady, and we ended up hiring 14 people. We bought a bunch of trucks, or leased a bunch of trucks, paper compactors, and had stuff set up all over. And this was great for like a year. You know, we were a year and a half. I bought a house, had a new vehicle, and I didn't save any money. And, you know, we had all these employees, all these overheads, you know, that we had to meet every month. And our payroll was $30,000 a month. And the market dropped out again. The government decided to start putting virgin pulp back in, and we ended up losing the business. And I couldn't produce tax records from 1995 because we made too much money, and I didn't want, it was cheaper for me just to say I can't find them. So I lost my house, I lost my car, I lost everything. And we went from a four-bedroom house to an apartment. Then from an apartment to a little shack, you know, shanty, pretty much. Then from there to a street hotel where you can live during the week. And, you know, it was not a good environment. So finally, I made enough money, I got a good job, and we got back into a house. Then we got kicked out of it because we partied too much. And this was all while my son was in high school, and I partied with him. And it was easier for me to do that than be responsible. You know, being responsible meant conflict, you know, punishment, and everything. It was just easier because I was afraid. I was by myself because his mom passed away in 1984 from this disease. She was in a scuba diving accident and drowned. So I'm by myself. I don't have anybody, you know, to back me up or anything. And it was just really scary. And I just ran from reality like I always did. But what happened was I like to fish. You know, I'm a big fisherman. And I was over in Cocoa Beach fishing on the pier one day. And I did it quite often. And I like to drink and drive. You know, I like to drink and do anything. And people have asked me, you know, before, says, man, I can't go around this place because I used to drink there. And I'm like, well, shit, dude, I got to hover about 3 feet off the ground because I drink everywhere. So it's great. I'm really grateful that, you know, the steps take care of that. But I'd been over there fishing. It was about 10 o'clock at night, and I've been drinking all day, you know, and I'd work. It was a Friday. It was October 30th, 1998. It was a Friday, and I'd gone to work like 5 o'clock in the morning, got off at 3, and I'd headed over there, you know, drinking tall boys all the way there. I'd stop at every 7-Eleven and buy a tall boy. I don't know why, I just didn't get a 6-pack or a 12-pack, but I started heading home, and I could remember, you know, I got really drunk. And then I came down a little bit, and I got in my car, and the first thing I did was stop at a 7-Eleven and buy another tall boy. Well, I ended up driving home and blacking out and probably falling asleep or passing out on the road. I remember one time I went off into the median doing like 70 miles an hour and woke me up. And I was going over the Indian River Bridge. And at the top, there's like a blind spot where the hump goes over and you can't see. When I came over the other side, there was a car that was stalled. And I hit it doing 65 miles an hour with no brake or anything. And I can remember it like it was yesterday, you know, the sound of the glass and the steel crashing and breaking. And I knew that, you know, it was probably pretty bad because I went all the way over the car. And I can remember looking down to my right and seeing the water because I was going down the rail of the bridge. And when I got over the car, I flipped back over onto my side and slid down the bridge. And the impact was really bad, so it damaged my car a lot, and I was trapped in the inside of my car. I was hanging upside down, couldn't get out. And I was in and out of consciousness because I hit my head really hard on the steering wheel. And I can remember one of the firemen, EMTs, saying that there had been one fatality. And there was no one with me, and I was alive, so I knew that I'd killed someone. And the fear just overwhelmed me. You know, I knew that I was screwed. I knew that I had alcohol in my system. There were beer cans in the car. There were other things in the car. And I remember being in the hospital, and the cop came in to ask me questions. And they didn't ask me any questions about the accident. They just asked me about insurance and stuff like that. And I remember asking her, you know, why were they stopped on the bridge? And she said, I don't know. But anyway, my best thought at that time, and this is sad because I had a child at home, was I am going to party like my life is over because I'm going to prison for a long time, so I'm going to enjoy what little bit of life I have left on the outside. And I should have been thinking about maybe I should stop drinking. Or maybe I should try to make it to where my son will have a comfortable life while I'm in prison, find a nice place for him to live. But I'll never forget the day that I told him that his daddy was probably going to prison. That was the first time I saw him cry. But I still couldn't stop drinking. I'd look in the mirror and I see someone there that I just hated. I asked God one day, I was watching a TV evangelist. His name's Jesse Duplantis. He was a Cajun preacher, and he said, after a sermon, I don't remember the sermon, but I remember him saying, if you don't believe God's real, ask him to reveal himself. Excuse me. So I did. And it wasn't instant. I remember I asked him to reveal himself to me, and it was almost like a dare, you know, because I was pissed and I knew that I'd ruined any chance that I ever had of God that I learned about caring for me, because I'd broken every commandment there was, even the thou shalt not kill. So I didn't think I had a chance with God. But I asked anyway, because I was desperate. And I kept drinking, you know, for a little while. And then that was right before the September 11th tragedy. And I remembered, you know, how horrible it all was, you know, the terror and, you know, the fear. And, you know, the country stopped and, you know, all the airplanes had stopped. And I'd never seen anything like that before in my life. And it was terrifying for everybody. But then a few days later, people started flying American flags. You'd hear God on TV, you know, which is politically incorrect. But you heard a lot of talk about God. You saw people praying in the streets. I said, maybe that's God showing himself to me. So that got me thinking, you know, that was a little bit of a God shot, you know. And then I would go on weekend benders, you know. I was making like $1,000 a week, and by Sunday, I get paid Friday, by Sunday I'd have $10 or $15 in my pocket. And I was living in what is known as a flop house. And that's where you live week to week and you pay a weekly rent. And my son had already been taken away from me. I'd been to jail countless times for other stuff, and my sister finally came and took him away from me. But he came back because he was tired of waiting on me to get sober, and this is where he grew up. So he came back and he was living in the flop house with me. And I remember I walked to the grocery store right down the street, came back, and I put what little bit of stuff I bought away, and I sat down in a rocking chair in my room, and it felt like I was getting ready to have a heart attack. My chest got really tight. I was having chest pains. My neck got all sweaty and hot. And right then was the first time I ever in my life thought about somebody else before I thought about me. And it was him. And I could remember thinking, what's going to happen when my son comes in here and finds me dead on the floor like he found his mother? And at that moment, God revealed himself to me. The obsession to drink and drug was lifted instantly, miraculously. And it was bad with me. Like I told you before, I'm a terrible obsessive. It was every minute, every second. When I had it, I was worried about running out of it. When I didn't have it, I was worried about getting it. You know, when I got it, I was feeling so great that I had it. I could never enjoy anything. But that moment, it was a split second. I went from being a fiend to not wanting to drink and use drugs anymore. And I was like, holy crap, you know. And I felt a presence in the room. I didn't see a white light, but I knew that things were going to be okay. So I called a friend of mine up that I'd lived with before, and he got sober, and he would always ask me if I'm ready, are you ready? And I never said I was ready. And then I called him up on the phone. I didn't say, hey Kevin, what's going on? Nothing like that. He answered the phone and I said, I'm ready. He asked me where I was, and he came and got me, and he brought me over to the little house that used to be here that was Central Orlando Group back in November 5th of 2001. That's when I took the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted to my innermost self that I was powerless over alcohol. I had no lurking notion. I had no reservation. I knew I was done. And I even told my son that day, I said, I'm done. He's like, yeah, right, whatever. I said, no, really, I'm done. And I knew it. I just knew I was done. Because that experience I had was, I knew there was a God, and I knew he was there to help me. And that's all I needed. So I think I did the first two steps that day. And I was introduced to a man named Roy Brooks. He's dead now. But he told me the truth. He didn't feel sorry for me. He had the same thing happen to him, except he did it a different way. And, you know, he didn't hold anything back. And he didn't pussyfoot around. You know, he either did what he said or he didn't care. He told me. He said, if you don't care, I don't care. And that scared me. But what he did was he introduced me to a higher power. And we knelt down on the floor together and we did the third step prayer. And I hadn't been to trial or anything yet for the DUI manslaughter. And I was 6 months sober and they called a pre-trial. And I didn't have any money. You know, I had a public defender. And then finally I fired the public defender and I said, you know what? I'm guilty. It's my responsibility to take the responsibility for what I'd done. So I went in and I admitted guilt. And I told the public defender that I didn't need him anymore. That I was going to represent myself. And that's what I did. And the judge looked at me and he says, do you know what you're doing? And I was like, yes, sir, I do know what I'm doing. I said, I'm admitting guilt to something that I did. It's my fault. And there's no other excuse for it. It was a heinous act. And I'm here to make amends. So he said, okay. And then state attorney came in and talked to me. And he says, now my sentence added up to 15 years. That's how many points I had. I had a 15-year sentence. Which if I would have got what I deserved, I'd still be in prison right now. Because I was convicted April of 2001. But what happened was, I had done the third step. And I was at peace. Even if I had to go to prison. Because Roy always said, there were only three things that he was afraid of. And one was being a missionary in Africa. One was being crippled. And one was going back to prison. And he had to accept those things because he said, you know what? He says, your higher power has the best in store for you than anything you could ever imagine. So you have to accept whatever it is he has in store. And, you know, I did. And then I did the fourth step, you know, because I wanted to hurry up. I knew I was probably going to prison. And he even told me, chances are you're going, so you might as well get ready. So I did the fourth step. And, you know, shared stuff with him, did the fifth step. And when I did that fifth step, the next morning I woke up, and I've never felt this before in my life, but I woke up and I didn't think of anything. My mind was blank. That's the first time it's ever happened to me. And it was peace of mind is what it was. I had peace of mind. I was free of all that crap from my mom and dad. From the dysfunction, from my anger. You know, my life has been an uphill battle. And even in sobriety, you know, and, you know, that thing they talk about, trudge the road to happy destiny. Well, I got trudging shoes on, man. Because there's been so many things happen to me in sobriety, and I'm still sober. And that's a miracle to me too. It's a miracle that I'm sitting here, you know, standing here talking to you. And the miracle is Alcoholics Anonymous. It says in the book that we are saved by an act of providence. The 12th tradition tells me that the only thing that's got me here is the grace of God. I can't take credit for anything. Nothing. No matter what has happened to me in sobriety, it's the grace of God. You know, it keeps me, that's the humility part of it, you know, to knowing that I'm only one drink away from a drunk, just like anybody else in here. Because my head will go off and say, oh, well, you got 10 years of sobriety. You can lay off for a little while, because I've done it. I don't have to go to so many meetings now. I don't have to help people. But you know what? There's no feeling like being in the middle of the herd, being plugged in and having that peace in my heart, because that's all I ever was looking for. I just didn't know it. was to have peace of mind and to, you know, because every time I felt pain, whether it was from a broken relationship or anything else, it's been here. You know, my pain is like a gut-wrenching pain. Feels like I've been kicked in the gut. And that's when I move away from my higher power. And I don't think he knows what's best for me. But 6 and 7, you know, keeps me busy. I have to keep praying for God to remove the defects of character that I have, because they're there, you know. And they're just as bad as they ever were. It's just I have a solution now. I have steps that when I make mistakes, I can apologize for it. Tonight speaking, the lady that died was Ramesh Patel that I killed. She didn't die. She had children. She had a husband. She had a mom, a dad, a sister, friends. The only way I can make amends to her is by to share this message that I'm sharing with you. And not to do it again. To stay sober and lead a sober life. That's the only amends that I can really, truly live for anyone. You know, I've made amends to people that I harmed. But there's people out there that if I'd have kept drinking, I would have hurt them too. So a living amends for me is to stay sober to anyone, like my family. They don't want to hear I'm sorry. They don't want to hear that. They heard it, you know. Get me out of jail. You know. Oh, I'm sorry. The only time I was ever sorry was when I got caught. You know, because I always did what I wanted to do. Thought the rules were for everybody else. And, you know, the relationship that I have with my higher power today is all from step 11. You know, it says, continue to improve our conscious contact. Continued. You know, I have to do it on a regular basis, daily. You know, my son's sitting in here tonight, a sober member of AA. And you think my life was screwed up? His was twice as bad as mine. He had me for a dad. But we've been praying together in the mornings. And it makes me feel so good to be a positive influence on someone I affected so negatively. I cherish those moments. You know, he never looked up to me until I got sober. See, I was a horrible creature in the cuffs of alcoholism. AA gave me dignity, integrity, responsibility, good judgment, intuitive thoughts, because these are all promises. And, you know, if you continue to stay in here and you do what's required, it'll happen. I moved away from here about 3 years ago, and it was beautiful where I lived. I lived over on the coast of Sarasota, and you know, I walked on the beach all the time, met a really nice woman, and life was great. But I got away from AA, and then my life started going to shit again. That's how you know if you're an alcoholic, you know.
Amen.
If you stop drinking and your life's getting better, you don't belong here. But if you stop drinking and your life still goes to shit and you hadn't worked the steps, you belong here. So you better get busy. But I felt the distance I have between AA, because it's different. There's no place like Central. Central is my home group, and it's my favorite because I got sober here and I know all the people here, and I come back every once in a while. And I didn't realize that I'd be living in Orlando again this quick, but life does that. I got laid off and I ended up moving back here, which is, you know, I feel so peaceful, and you know, I'm plugged back into AA. I'm helping other people, going to meetings on a regular basis. And that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I know what my purpose in life is. It's to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. That's the 12th step. And hopefully I've done that tonight. You know, I grow spiritually when I make myself vulnerable. And it's like it just fulfills my heart to get up here and speak. You see me cry up here, you know, that's not cries of sadness, which it should be. But God has forgiven me, and I've made amends to all the people that I've harmed. Those are tears of gratitude for what AA has done for me. You know, I'm grateful that I'm one of the chosen ones, because that act of providence they talk about, not everybody gets it. But I did. And I'm really grateful to be here tonight, and I'm really grateful that I got a chance to share with you people. Thanks.